But it was one of the properties. Our preserve in Sonora, Mexico, was comprised of 9 different individual ranches. One of them was called Los Ojos. At the time, the founder of the organization decided that that's what she was going to call the organization. And so it loosely translates to the watershed of Los Ojos, which was specifically one of those properties that we currently manage. Obviously, we're much larger than that now, but the name has stuck. The organization is a little over 30 years old, the majority of which was under a private family foundation. The work that we are currently doing now is, we're probably about 5 years as a 501c3, nonprofit organization. So the work has been ongoing for a long time, both in the United States and Mexico. But in terms of our current organizational structure and kind of our new strategic, path, it's much younger than that. I think borderlands in general are very, very misunderstood areas of a country simply because they're out of sight and out of mind for a large portion of the population. But what people need to realize is that they're borderlands only in name, right? They're a man-made construct in terms of the geopolitical boundaries that have been put in place, when in reality, since the beginning of human and animal existence on these continents, no one observed a border, right? I mean, these are cultures and communities and societies and lineages that have adapted and migrated and been linked without a border. It was like, hey, I'm in Mexico, now I'm in the United States. And until things started to evolve where there was more of a physical barrier between dividing the landscape, that's when things began to become problematic. The borderlands are actually some of the richest locations where you're going to find some of the most biodiverse, both plant and animal species on the continent, because you're looking at transitions in continental landscapes, right? You're going from the Sonoran and Chihuahuan Desert up into the central coastal plains of Texas and up into the Midwest. The Sierra Madre mountain range that we currently work in there in Mexico is really an extension of what we know as the Rocky Mountains in the States, right? So these are literally continental sized landscapes we were talking about, and the border in and of itself is a very small part, but it's also a very important part. So I think coming full circle on this question, borderlands are extremely important because of the intersection of certain landscapes, certain cultures, certain communities, and really just the genetic biodiversity that exists is you're going to be hard pressed to find that elsewhere in the world. The wall, I mean, the reality is, I mean, you look at the Great Wall of China, you look at this border wall, you look at other walls that have existed throughout Europe, the physical barrier creates a significant impact on the landscape, right? There's no question that it has impacted the movement north and south of animals. It has not stopped the movement of people. It's made it more challenging, but it's not going to stop people from having to move from bad situations to hopefully better situations. I mean, human migration across the globe has not been deterred by physical barriers. It has just made it more painful, more costly. But at the end of the day, it's also not the right answer. There's Friendship Park over in California, which has been a binational park for decades. And it is being, desecrated and demolished, and a new section, a 30-foot wall being built, which is even further just opening up a scab between countries, when the whole intent between a binational park was to bring our countries closer together, right? You have the 30-foot wall that exists primarily through all the southern border of Arizona, which has created a significant amount of problems, both for water issues, wildlife issues, people issues. New Mexico, thankfully, thus far still has a good chunk of land in that border region that's not barricaded up. It has some barriers, but it doesn't have that 30-foot wall that is, you customarily see. And then, as you've seen in the news recently, I mean, just the devastation and what's taking place on the Rio Grande, in Texas, is just barbaric. And it's not, again, not the right answer. People are being affected. Wildlife is being affected. The natural environment is being affected. And again, I'm not saying that there are not issues that both sides need to work on, but this is not the right approach to create solutions. We manage a 121,000 acre preserve. Our preserve shares a 30-mile border with the United States. And these are natural migratory corridors from all of your megafauna your big cats, your deer, all the way down to rabbits, right? I mean, all bears, all of these animals are moving through the landscape. And so there was a period of time which it became very challenging for any animals to migrate through some of those natural corridors. But recently, there's been a number of folks on the U.S. side, both federal agencies, nonprofits, individuals, et cetera, working with the Department of Justice to settle some outstanding lawsuits, namely issues related to waivers of environmental laws that were done kind of carte blanche in order to construct the wall. And the outcome of that recent settlement agreement was that certain areas across this southern border, let me back up for one second. When they built the wall, obviously there's low-lying areas throughout the course of the border, right? There's rivers that cross north and south. There's drainages, et cetera, arroyos and everything. Well, in the construction of the wall were built these massive gates, MIG steel metal gates that could be locked. But during the rain season, the monsoon season, they could be opened, and they opened to the United States, obviously, because they can't go into Mexico. And the intent was to enable floodwaters to go north to south. Well, during that periodic opening throughout the year, that then created additional options for animals to move through. Because, I mean, you could drive a semi truck through them. They're really big gates. But then they were closed outside of the rainy season. Well, this recent settlement agreement, one of the solutions that was agreed to was that certain gates throughout the length of this wall would be opened permanently. So while, I could tell you maybe 3 months ago, many of us were still very concerned and worried that this was going to be a much longer fight to get openings, permanent openings throughout the wall in strategic locations. And this settlement occurred. This is somewhat of a happy medium in the sense that we can get openings, large enough openings for animals to move back and forth. The people migrating issue, you've probably heard stories and read articles about, it's a very simple, for $30, you can buy a piece of rope at Home Depot and really people can scale the wall. They've cut it. I mean, that was never going to stop people, right? But we are doing what we can to ensure that animals have the ability to start moving back and forth. When the wall was closed and there was instances where water was scarce as the animals are looking for, because there's a significant amount of water sources that the animals use on both sides of the border. And if they couldn't get to one, you did in certain circumstances see animals who died because they couldn't figure out the wall. They couldn't figure out how to get across. And it was just too late. Yeah. I think what people need to be mindful of is in this region, there's a big discussion really across the country, right, about pollinator species, right? Your bees, your butterflies, all of those insects that, not many of them really fly 30 feet up in the air. They tend to scoot along at a much lower altitude, and these obstacles can get in their way. And so there's been a huge concern amongst the environmental community along the border that the inability of pollinators to move back and forth into their traditional ranges, we don't yet know the full impact. I mean, people are researching that, they're studying that, they're trying to do counts, but it's a significant concern. No, there's no question. They are extremely critical both in Mexico and the United States. We're doing our best to get the message out where we can and how we can. There's still so much of it lost in the narrative of, this border wall and why it was put up in the first place, to combat, hordes of people from South America and Mexico trying to come north when in reality, that's not the case. There are still people trying to come north. I'm not denying that. But in terms of the reasoning that was provided to the American public as to why this was a good idea, the environmental side of that discussion really has gotten lost in the all of the static surrounding some of the other, politically charged issues, which is unfortunate. But I can represent that there are a large number of groups, again, from Texas all the way to California, that are engaged daily advocating for the environmental side of the impacts that have been brought about by the construction of the border wall, and bring attention to the fact that, hey guys, we've got, continental species related issues here, where we if we do not come up with a solution, we really stand to set back the genetic diversity that has been happening for eons. we don't want to see a situation where you start to get populations of species that, stay north and south because they're no longer able, to cross that border and create that genetic diversity. I think it goes back to this misconception, like, oh, the borderland could be a wasteland. It's just open desert. And the fact of the matter is it's not. It's extremely alive. The terrain is beautiful, mountainous. You get peaks over 8,000 feet and valleys, full valleys, grassland, wide open grassland valleys. And so, yeah, it's if you look at various literature and research that's out there, they call this particular region of the world the Sky Island region. And it gets its name from the fact that there are mountain ranges interspersed with seas of grasslands. And so you get this amazing juxtaposition of topography with these wide open expanses of grasslands and then elevation that, where you'll get pines and aspens and junipers, things that you might find up in the Rockies. So this distinct elevation, all of which exists in this Sonoran Desert region, it's literally one of the most biodiverse hotspots on the globe.
Yeah. The monkey speaks his mind. Now, three monkeys sat in a coconut tree, discussing things as they are said to be. Said one to the other, now listen, you two, there's a certain rumor that can't be true. That man descended from our noble race, the very idea is a big disgrace. No monkey ever deserted his wife, starved her baby, and ruined her life. Yeah. The monkey speaks his mind. And you never known a mother monk to leave the babies with others to bone, or pass them on from one to another till they scarcely knew who was their mother. Yeah. The monkey speaks his mind.
My name is Sarah Rogers, and I am a litigation fellow with the Animal Legal Defense Fund. What that means is that I am an attorney who works with the litigation department, and what we do is bring impact litigation to further the interests, the protections of animals in a variety of ways. That's companion animals, farmed animals, and wildlife, both captive and wildlife. My team is specifically focused on litigation, but we also have a legislative team. We have a criminal justice aspect. We have an education piece where they do a lot of conferences and education at law schools. So we're pretty multifaceted, but I am specifically part of that litigation piece and do a bit of regulatory type work as well. Yeah, so I've always been passionate about animal advocacy and working with animals, but it was very much like a personal aspect of my life. Like, I volunteered with cats in shelter and became a vegetarian when I was 13 and later went vegan. But I decided in my late 20s that I wanted to go to law school. I'd been working in an adjacent field doing like support for litigation. And when I was looking for law schools, I found Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland. And I was living in Seattle at the time, and they had an entire animal law program. I didn't even know animal law was a thing you could study. and I knew I wanted to do public interest work for sure. So it was just like, oh, maybe I can work in animal law. That sounds really cool. So I ended up going through that program, and I graduated a couple of years ago and have been working for ALDF since. So it was kind of really special to be able to unite what I was passionate about personally with law, which I was looking at as, a career. We talk about animal law, but really it's just applying all aspects of law to animals. So it can involve anything from a contract issue that involves an animal to freedom of speech issues that involve animals to enforcing cruelty laws to doing work with wildlife like I do to enforce the Endangered Species Act. So it's very, very broad. It really covers all aspects of law and just finding these creative ways to use the law to further the interests of animals. Sometimes it's federal, sometimes it's state, but it's really present everywhere. So I think what's nice when people decide to, you know, maybe study animal law or interested, you can do it in a variety of ways. You could be at a law firm and do pro bono work that helps the environment or animals. You could be dealing with divorces that involve animals, or you could be working for an organization like I do. Oregon has, I believe it's an assistant district attorney who specifically deals with wild or animal crimes against animals. So yeah, it's actually, there's a lot to do. And now you have, you know, the plant-based meat companies and things like that, where maybe you'd be interested in working for one of those as an attorney. So there's just a lot of avenues now, which is very cool. So ALDF in particular, I was not at ALDF when our border wall litigation happened. But we, the litigation team did bring litigation in 2017 after Trump issued his executive order about the border wall. There were a couple of aspects of that that a lot of public interest organizations challenged. That includes organizations that protect, you know, animals like we do, the environment, all sorts of different entities. Obviously, people were affected by the decision to build these portions of the wall. So ALDF specifically was focused on, the first suit that we brought was about the Department of Homeland Security waiving a bunch of typical requirements for projects like a border wall to expedite it. So typically there are the dozens of laws that would affect the construction of something like the border wall. You would have to go through a pretty intensive process under, for example, NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act, where you go through this process if the government wants to build something like a border wall or construct something like this, where you have to look at the environmental impact. And it's a multi-part process, and there are multiple parts within the parts. So it's not something that can happen quickly. And then with the Endangered Species Act, federal agencies agree to adhere to that act in order to protect endangered and threatened wildlife, and also the habitats that they live in. So the areas that are, you know, required for them to flourish are protected as well. It's this critical habitat. And typically you can't just start constructing a wall. You need to go and get an exemption to go against what the Endangered Species Act is protecting. So basically, Department of Homeland Security, citing the Real ID Act, which in 2005, it was a post 9/11 border wall act, they said that they had the authority under that act to continue construction of the wall and waive all of these protections. So we challenged that. A bunch of people challenged that. There were later challenges involving Trump's emergency. There's an emergency order as well that put more resources toward the wall in 2019. And yes, so we were involved in that. And ultimately, our lawsuit wasn't necessarily like the nail in the coffin. The lawsuit with the DHS ended up, it was appealed and it didn't go up to the Supreme Court. But when Biden took office in 2021, he did, you know, stop the construction. But there's still a bunch of fallout from that. And a lot of animals have been harmed. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, they put out a report basically outlining the issues that have happened, like the detrimental effects that the portions of wall that went up actually had. And so I know that remediation is supposed to be coming, and it sounds like some of it's happening, but wildlife passage is a huge issue. And that's because it affects the daily travel of wildlife, but also migration. It's dividing populations that are extremely at risk that need to breed with each other in order to help the species proliferate and continue. You have species such as the ocelot. They're extremely endangered, and they're fragmented, you know, between Mexico and the U.S. And in the GAO report, they basically said, yeah, like it caused a barrier between these two populations, and it severely increased the risk of extinction. Courts have a really hard time, it seems, sometimes conceptualizing how we can know what animals want. It's these basic freedoms, the freedom to move, the freedom of choice, the freedom to engage in their normal behaviors, right? The freedom to interact with their ecosystem and be in their native habitats when we're talking about wildlife. So we have many ways of determining how an animal is being affected by its environment and knowing, you know, these basic needs that animals have, which I think it, to some extent, aren't so different from our own, right? We want to be able to have families. We want to be able to live without the stress of someone keeping us in an enclosure or separating us from our family, from our environment. An area that I'm particularly interested in that I think this really is evident, I think pigeons are a really interesting example of that, because pigeons, they were domesticated, right? And then we brought them to the United States and we kind of just let them go. So they were feral. And then they started to adapt to their environment, adapt to their ecosystem. So they are adapted now as wildlife, but they really were just these feral animals. But they grew in our cities. They're used to living in close proximity with us, but people view them as a nuisance. So they have no protection. Like, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act doesn't cover them because they're not a native. They're not part of a treaty. They're not I forget what the exact term is, but they're not native to the United States. Naturally, I don't know what the exact phrase is, but like naturally coming from the United States, even though at this point they do reproduce and live all over the United States. But you can, in most jurisdictions, just kill them as a nuisance. But it's our fault they're here, right? Like, we brought them here and we're the reason they're all over our cities. They're a really interesting example. And a big issue is, even if there are laws that, you know, technically are in place to protect animals, what's protection without enforcement, right? So even if there's a law that protects an animal that's in captivity, if it's not being enforced, the animal's, you know, languishing potentially in bad conditions. In the U.S., there's been a couple of different attempts for personhood for animals. We had one case that was very procedural where a court recognized an animal involved in a foreign lawsuit, a foreign conflict, was a person of interest in the suit. So that was a very big deal. But a lot of the personhood cases in the U.S. so far have not been successful. There's been some really good commentary. There's been some really good, some judges who dissented in decisions that were like, hey, like, times are changing. Like, like when you're looking at an elephant, like, this is an animal that can't be held in a box. Like, they're so complex. They're so smart. I like to think of it not necessarily in terms of like cognition when I look at like rights for animals, because cognition varies in people too. Like, I don't think that should be like the core of whether or not you have freedom and rights. In the United States, there has been a shift with companion animals, so the animals that we live with. I think that in both just a cultural sense and then in terms of like legislation that gets passed and the way that courts deal with companion animals, we do view them as more than just property, which is their technical legal status. But I think with wildlife, it seems that we put our own needs first a lot when it comes to things like the border wall or fencing or architecture to keep wildlife away from our property. And I think that that really has the effect of like perpetuating a hierarchy and perpetuating just an othering. Because I think, and I'm sure people have talked about this in the human context, but when a wall goes up or a fence goes up, I think that does something in our brain. I think it automatically creates either a hierarchy or an us and them. And I think that can be seen in the captive wildlife situation too. Like, when you look at an animal in a zoo and they're behind bars, it sort of normalizes that. And it puts the animal in the place of being something that can be behind bars, because it's okay if we confine this living being. But I think, yeah, with the border wall, I mean, this was a human conflict and that was the focus. The focus was the human conflict. Let's bulldoze everything else. Let's waive every law we can to get this done, because this is my platform and there's hate swirling and everything else. And it seems like, I mean, the environment and animals and just everyday people and, you know, religious sites and drinking water, I mean, all of that just became secondary to what they wanted to do. It's interesting because it feels like these conflicts just trickle into like affecting animals in ways you might not expect. Like, when you're talking about logging, well, with the logging in the Pacific Northwest, which is where I am, it turned into like, we're reducing habitats, and then you have animals that are coming into conflict. So you have an endangered owl who's fighting for space with a non-endangered owl. And so permits are being given out to cull the non-endangered owl. And it's like, they didn't make this conflict happen. We made it happen. But now owls are losing their lives. The tensions between countries, like, that's never good for trying to, again, like, enforce laws. So, like, we both want to protect these endangered species, but how are we going to work together when our governments are creating these conflicts? And also, I think just when we talk about fencing and walls and ways to keep animals out, like, there are a lot of good ways to do it, and there are a lot of bad ways to do it. So there are guides on how to put up fencing, if you need to put up fencing, that give you ways to consider maybe using native plants if you can instead, or if you really need a barrier, ways to allow wildlife to go back and forth and not get snagged or stuck in a certain material, or, you know, making it the right height so animals can clear it or go under that need to be able to move past, so you're not separating families. Because, for instance, if a fence is too high, maybe the adult of a species can get over it, but the young animal can't. So you're literally separating families. But these separations just really fragment habitats, and they affect really delicate ecosystems that really need all those parts to be able to kind of live together. And I think something that's really interesting, that's been a really good solution, is wildlife crossings. I don't know if you're, you know, familiar with those, but they were, in 2021, there was a big bipartisan infrastructure package passed by Congress, and it gave a bunch of money to grants to help promote these wildlife crossings. And what that does is, I mean, roads obviously are a huge issue for wildlife and people, and when they conflict with each other, lives are lost, a lot of money is spent. So these wildlife crossings can come in the form of tunnels, they can be bridges, they can be, I think they're called culverts, which are sort of like tubes where they put the land around them. So it sort of looks like a drainage tube. But if you can construct them properly and kind of do the right research to really make them work for the wildlife in the area, it can have drastic reduction in deaths due to traffic collision with wildlife. Here in the Pacific Northwest, there's been more like overpasses and underpasses being done. And I think that that's great. Like, it's just, I mean, it's existed longer elsewhere. I think the U.S. was a little slow in getting up to speed with these because they do cost money. But I feel like in the cost-benefit analysis, like, investing this money now in these wildlife overpasses, it's better than the loss of life and the money that goes into having to, you know, repair after collisions. So there are ways to make it work, fences, having those passages open when barriers are needed. And I think that people are becoming more aware of them, and hopefully, I don't know, this was a huge crisis with the border wall. And I just hope that whatever happens, we only go in the right direction in remediating the damage that has been done, not going backward.
Thank you for listening to part 5 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. Or do they? The poem Affirmation, written by Asada Shakur, was read by Samantha Rogers and Lujane Asale. The program also includes excerpts from an interview with Charles Bowden, and Tara Vajri read her poem, Artist, Refugee. The recording of Howling Wolves is from the National Park Service Audio Library. Music by Jamie Branch, Freddie Fender and Rai Cooter, New Model Army, Michael Franti and Spearhead, Hanin y Son Cubano, Anais Mitchell and the cast of Hadestown, and Dave Bartholomew. We want to thank Elizabeth Vallée, Jeremiah Leibowitz, and Sarah Rogers for their willingness to be part of this program. Find out more about our guests at biglobalization.org, cuencalosojos.org, and aldf.org. This show was produced by Emily Charles and Mary Salome, a Queer in Your Ear production.
And another thing you will never see, a monkey build a fence around a coconut tree and let other coconuts go to waste, forbidding all other monkeys to come and taste. Why, if I put a fence around this tree, starvation would force you to steal from me. Yeah, the monkey speaks his mind. Here's another thing a monkey won't do. Go out at night and get on a stew. I use a gun, a club, or knife to take another's